This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
What I worry about with reform most of all is it's a very powerful, simplistic message. To be honest, it comes across to me like those adverts online with this one simple life hack, you could be slim, or this one simple life hack, you know, you can be beautiful or more productive. It's that level of politics, and I think it's very hard to deal with when the truth is that actually getting real change on the ground that is sustainable and lasts takes a lot of effort on a lot of different fronts.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the final Kent Politics Podcast of 2024. In the week, local government started the painful business of putting itself out of business and, well, starting all over again. The government white paper into English devolution will almost certainly mean that Kent County Council, Medway Council and every other council in Kent will cease to be within 3 or 4 years and will have a mayor. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and with me is Robert Boddy, who's been looking at Medway Council this week.
Hello.
And Daniel Edson, who covers district and borough councils in Kent.
Hello there.
And also joining us is KM Media Group senior news editor Nikki White.
Hello.
Okay, first up, what's been happening in your day job at Medway?
Election fever is back. This week, Medway's three new Labour MPs, Lauren Edwards for Rochester and Stroud, Nishaba Khan for Gillingham and Raynham, and Tristan Osborne for Chatham and Aylesford, have resigned as councillors on Medway Council, wanting to focus on their parliamentary duties. This means by-elections for two seats on the authority in Rochester East and Warren Wood, and one in Gillingham South will take place in February.
How could these by-elections change in the makeup of the council?
So the current position is Labour hold a majority of seven. So they have 33 Labour, including two Labour members currently suspended following an incident last year, the investigation of which is ongoing, and 26 from Conservatives, the Independent Group and Independent Councillor combined. If Labour lost all three by-elections, the Labour group would be reduced to 30 councillors to the opposition party's 29, giving them a majority of just one.
How likely is that to happen?
On paper, not very likely, to be honest. Gillingham South has elected exclusively Labour members since 2015, prior to that electing Liberal Democrat councillors and never having voted for Tories. Rochester East and Warren Wood similarly has been dominated by Labour. However, don't think that the Tories in particular, but other parties as well, won't throw the kitchen sink at these contests in an effort to capitalise on national discontent with the new Labour government. It's bound to be an interesting few weeks, culminating on February 6th.
Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I've been watching the ever-shifting Rainbow Coalition at Swale Borough Council, which has gotten three smaller this week as a result of Labour's planning policy changes.
So who's jumped ship and why on this occasion?
It may not surprise you to hear it was the Green Party. All three of them on Swale Borough Council pulled out of their coalition with Labour and the Swale Independents. Last week, Labour released their updated national planning policy framework, which basically the rules governing house building and setting new mandatory housing targets for councils. Swale's Greens say it's, you know, just a developer's charter to concrete over the countryside, and so they bailed out on their coalition.
Mm. So why Swale though? I mean, are the new targets likely to affect the area that much?
Not the new housing targets, no, to be honest. The new targets will see Swale's yearly house building number increased by only 8 homes every year, up to 1,048, at least that's the target. In theory, that will be more strictly enforced though. Places like Sevenoaks or Tunbridge Wells are looking at, you know, way, way higher increases. But in Swale, this scandal is compounded by the fact that the new Labour MP, Kevin McKenna, who we're speaking to later on, played a small role in getting a decision over Highstead Park, an 8,400 home development near Sittingbourne, taken off of Swale Borough Council and given to the government, who are widely believed to be much more likely to approve it.
And is the council going to struggle because the Greens are dropping out of the coalition?
Not yet, at any rate. The Labour and Swale Independents still have a majority between them, and the council has a committee system anyway, so it's not like it'll force a change of leader or anything like that. Mike Baldock, the Swale Independents leader, tells me that they share all the Greens' concerns about house building. Like many independent groups, they were essentially founded as an anti-house building organisation. But they're staying in the coalition because a budget needs to be passed soon, and it'd be irresponsible to endanger that process by ripping up a majority voting block on the council. But he did say they're divided on it, so maybe all it takes is a little bit more housing-related scandal.
A big week at Kent County Council, Simon. What's the latest?
Well, the words on everyone's lips at the moment are devolution and reform. And I will be coming on to that in much greater detail later on. But the one thing that seems to be really exercising people at the moment is if Kent County Council elections will actually take place next year. Nobody seems to know. The timelines are all very blurry, but potentially Kent could have its own mayor in situ by May 2026 and a new unitary authority structure by May 2027. That's the sort of the earliest time frame.
And how would that affect the KCC elections?
Well, they're due next May, and the question is, do all 14 council leaders agree that it makes sense to go ahead, or better ask the Secretary of State to delay the elections for about a year until everybody knows the score? The Minister this week hinted he would consider secondary legislation to delay the polls in regions looking to accelerate council reforms. The senior bodies and people I've spoken to are pretty much split, but the KCC leader and the leader of Medway Council will have to make their intentions known to the Minister by January the 10th.
Do the Tories want an election they might lose?
Well, probably not, because there's a consensus they may not do very well. But the government might like the idea of a short-term arrangement where the Tories are not in charge, perhaps even led by a Labour-led rainbow coalition at County Hall. These are very exciting but uncertain times at County Hall. And as I said, we talk about this in greater detail a little later on. So what's been happening at Westminster, Nikki?
Christmas is a time of giving. We're coming up to Christmas, and now would have been the perfect time to deliver some good news and perhaps a cash windfall for millions of women. However, that hasn't happened, and many MPs, including some from Kent, are furious after Work and Pensions Secretary Liz Kendall announced this week that the government would not be paying compensation to the WASPI women. For those of you that don't know, what WASPI stands for, Women Against State Pension Inequality, and the campaign group was set up to protest against changes to increase the state pension age for women. The group itself doesn't oppose the equalisation of the state pension age, but it does want those women who have been affected by this decision to be compensated, because they say the government failed to tell them or provide adequate notice about the changes. They reckon there's about 3.6 million women that were affected by the 1995 decision to increase the pension age to 65, and of those, 2.6 million were affected by the decision to bring that date forward to 2018. Opponents say many have been forced to continue working past their expected retirement age, or they're now living on significantly less than they had planned and have suffered as a result. So back in March, the Health Ombudsman ruled that the government had failed to properly inform those women that the state pension age had changed, and recommend that there were payments of between £1,000 and £2,950, which was less than what WASPI had called for. They wanted a figure closer to £10,000, but at least it was something. However, this week, Ms Kendall has announced in the Commons that there will be no compensation at all. Now, campaigners have branded that decision as bizarre and totally unjustified, and it's led to a barrage of criticism from MPs, some from within the government's own party. Ms Kendall said the government accepted the Ombudsman's finding of maladministration, and they have apologised for what was a 28-month delay in writing to those women. However, she said the evidence showed that most of the women affected did know that there was a state pension age was changing, and therefore any blanket compensation scheme, which is going to cost up to £10 billion, would not be a proportionate use of taxpayers' money, and therefore they just couldn't justify it. She said they were also trying to put a tailored compensation scheme together, which would take into individuals' circumstances. It just wasn't feasible. As you can imagine, this news hasn't gone down well in many circles. One of those to criticise the decision was Faversham and Mid-Kent Tory MP Helen Whateley, and she said it was hypocrisy, and I quote, "no surprise that Labour have broken the promises that they made to WASPI women in opposition." She said that yet again, Labour had said one thing to get elected and were now doing another, just like they had no plans to take the winter fuel payment from 10 million pensioners. Independent MP for Canterbury Rosie Duffield, she described it as a kick in the teeth, and she said she felt ashamed and angry and so very sorry. She said the decision wasn't good enough and that Parliament had failed them.
Sittingbourne and Sheppey was touted as a seat to watch at the general election, with predictions for it flipping every which way until the day of the poll itself. But on the 4th of July, Labour's Kevin McKenna took the constituency, and he joins us now. Kevin, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, actually.
Thank you very much for joining us. It's a busy time. First, you were in the news last week when it emerged that you've written to Angela Rayner, the Secretary of State to Housing, asking her to call in the Hystead Park planning application for 8,500 homes around Sittingbourne. The local council is set to refuse it, but basically this means the government can decide on whether it goes ahead or not, much to the consternation of locals. We've spoken to people in Sittingbourne who say MPs shouldn't meddle in council matters, the local roads can't take it, infrastructure is crumbling, that kind of thing.
It's just ridiculously cramped in Sittingbourne now, and I don't think we have the infrastructure for it. And I'd question, why did he decide to take it out of the council's hands?
He only got in with 300 votes.
Really?
Yeah, only 300 votes, really close between Conservative and Reform. I mean, is he going to get in next time? Do you think people will vote for him after this?
I think if he does something like that, the answer would be no. Because what's the next thing he's going to do if he decides to overstep the council and overstep local people who have lived here for many years?
In the end, I think, you know, there's a lot of resistance to housing, but unfortunately it's got to come. And I don't like it any more than anybody else, because obviously with the doctors and the health service in general, and there's no infrastructure, the schools, the shops.
I mean, the whole thing about having your own councils in any town is they make local decisions. Parliament and all the rest of them, the MPs, if they want to make big decisions in Parliament, don't interfere with the local government. Let the local government deal with local events. It's as simple as that.
What would you say with, you know, to residents who disagree with you and think that development will be, you know, a disaster, bearing in mind you only got about a third of a vote in July and haven't lived in the town as long as many have?
To be clear, obviously, when Labour got elected to government, we had a very, 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 very strong line on building a lot of houses in this country as a whole, at 1.5 million houses. I mean, the Conservatives actually asked for 1.6 million, so a little bit more than us. So either party in government would be facing a need to build a lot of housing. And I do get there is a lot of anxiety around the high street development. It's a big plan. It's a big piece of strategic development. And it's not just about the housing. It's also would involve building a new eastern bypass for Sittingbourne. At the moment, if you've ever driven around Sittingbourne, most of the time it's a traffic jam. And it's really hard to get around. Part of that is because a bypass on the eastern side that was promised years and years ago has never been built. There's never been government money for it. There's no local government money for it. But this development would actually pay for that. And I've got a part of my constituency, a housing estate in East Hall, where people, literally there's only one road in and out. This would be their exit route, but also would connect really, really big, important parts of the local economy, Sheerness Docks, all of the industrial sites in Kemsley and Sittingbourne, and the Kent Science Park to the M2. So that's a big thing in itself. And people do talk about infrastructure, and they don't just mean roads. They also mean schools and GP surgeries and so on. And, you know, these plans as they are at the moment, they promise secondary school, primary schools, health centre, a new home for Sittingbourne FC. So there's a lot of promises with it. I mean, in truth, though, people are right to be wary of developers and their promises. We've had a lot locally where, you know, developers haven't followed through on what they've promised. And because this is so big, because it's such a big strategic decision, I felt actually it needed to be looked at by the planning inspector nationally. Particularly because locally in Swale Borough Council, there's been a lot of debate about it. But to be honest, a lot of that it's not coming to a conclusion. And there was a big dispute between the interpretation that the developer was saying and the interpretation of some people locally. So I wanted to cut through that mess because we are trying to bring real change to the country. I get homes built and the infrastructure we need to support jobs.
So usually when we go out onto the street and ask random members of the public, you know, what do you think about this or that council development? You know, usually they look at us like we're mad and they have no idea what we're talking about because they don't sit in a council chamber. But lots of people on the street sitting more knew about this development. And it, you know, surprising, basically a lot of people were very unhappy about it, and especially the fact that, essentially, there's a lot of people living in Sittingbourne for a long time, seen it get progressively more built up and has all the infrastructure problems you mentioned. And it seemed to many they perceived it as a new MP who, you know, lived in the area, correct me if I'm wrong, a few months, and basically come in and said that, you know, what you need is 8,000 homes. You know, do you think your argument that that's the mandate of national government and that supersedes their concerns, while that may be politically legitimate, do you think that will serve you well in Sittingbourne in future? Do you think residents would back that?
So obviously I've been talking to a lot of people in the constituency. I'm really trying to get to the bottom of what matters to people. Absolutely. There are several big concerns related to this. In the area, access to nature is really important. And people are very proud of the local countryside and want to protect that, I understand. And also Sittingbourne itself has been very, very badly served by the development that's happened over the last few years. So it's been subjected to piecemeal development around the edges of the town, and where a small estate of housing is built that doesn't have GP surgery, doesn't have a good road connect network to the local roads, doesn't have the things that a community needs to thrive. And it's just been added block by block by block by block to the edge of Sittingbourne. And of course that puts more pressure on the traffic in the centre. And of course that puts more pressure on local schools and services, because those services are not built into these developments. It's time to break through that. So Heisted is only one part of this. So Heisted does involve the infrastructure that people have been asking for. And if it's assessed that it is what's needed, if it's assessed that we can trust the developers and we can basically hold the developers' feet to the fire so that they build this bypass and the other things they've promised, that in itself is very different to the development we've had up to now. And then I want to flip things round, because while we've been building all of these little pocket estates on the edge of Sittingbourne, it's just been getting wider and wider, we've been letting the centre of the town atrophy. So the centre of Sittingbourne, one of the things that's biggest in my inbox from people in Sittingbourne is antisocial behaviour in the high street, the fact that we don't have the shops there that people want, the fact that the life and vibrancy from the town has gone, and then also a lot of people who frankly don't always speak up as loudly as some others because they're doing other things with their lives, that we've got a lot of young people who are struggling to get starter homes. So we're short of one bed flats, we're short of two bed flats, we're short of the places where people can get their lives started, and we have a lot of people locally who are either still living with their parents, unable to start families, or they're leaving the area altogether. Both of which are bad results for Sittingbourne. So I want to move things around beyond Heisted to really start saying, locally, we need to look at the centre of the towns, revitalise that, and come up with a really strong, comprehensive plan for if we're going to build the houses people need, they need to be right in the centre of Sittingbourne, coupled to a regeneration of the high street, and really thinking about what the town could be for the future over the next few decades.
So just stepping back a little bit, could you tell us a little bit about your life and times and how it is you came to be in politics and what you did before being an MP?
It was not a lifetime ambition to be an MP, even though I've always liked politics and been a bit of a political obsessive in terms of following politics, which I know is probably a bit of a niche hobby. But I never wanted to be an MP. I spent most of my life being a nurse. So and even that, it wasn't an ambition when I was a child either. I think I've gone through my life not knowing what I was going to do until it seemed like the right thing. I trained as a nurse in the late 90s, and I spent most of my time working in intensive care. So that's my clinical background. And then for the last few years, just before becoming an MP, I've been working at NHS England, which is the national coordinating organisation for the NHS, helping on national projects, understanding health policy, really getting to the bottom of what some of the problems the NHS faces, but also actually just what's the problem of the NHS is really important, but what really matters is people's health and how they live. And getting to the bottom of that was what that job at NHS England was about. And one of the things that comes out really strongly of where we've got some of the biggest challenges in healthcare in the country are coastal communities. They're rural communities and they're towns that have lost a lot of their employment or old purpose. And Sittingbourne and Sheppey is where all three of those. So all the challenges to social services and the health system in rural areas, coastal areas, and areas of high deprivation are right here within this seat, which is one of the reasons I was so keen to represent it in Parliament.
And how was it you ended up representing Sittingbourne and Sheppey? Because as I recall, are you from sort of Bexley, Kentish side of Greater London. How did you end up representing Sittingbourne and Sheppey? Did someone approach you?
I was born, of course, as a kid, but we spent a lot of time coming down to Kent and coming down the holidays. And, our first caravan holiday was in Faversham. And the last one I had was in Seasalter, and this was a place we used to come to a lot as a kid, and of course most weekends. So I got lots of connections and family and friends around here in the whole sort of northwest Kent area. And then I decided to try and put myself forward for parliamentary selection, which is how the Labour Party, in the Labour Party, it's the local members get to decide who's going to be their MP.
Until the leadership has a favourite, of course, in which case.
The leadership has a favourite. Well, I mean, much as I love the party leadership, and I'm very, I'm very fan of government, I'm not sure that I'm that well known by the party leadership, whatever people may think, yet. So I put myself forward for Rochester News Tribune, actually. I was really keen to run as a to get selected there. And then didn't get that. We've got fantastic MP there with Lauren. And then off the bat, particularly with the flurry around the election, Sittingbourne, I hadn't selected an MP at that point. So coming up to the summer. So my hat got put in the ring right at the last minute, which is why it was all a bit chaotic around that summer. Mm. The whole year's been a blur, if I'm honest.
So as I mentioned, in July, you won in Sittingbourne and Sheppey, but I think it might have won the tightest. It's definitely the tightest seat in Kent, I think, and I reckon probably won the tightest in the country. It was only by 355 votes of the Tories and Reform neck and neck in second and third, meaning, you know, I think there's about 71% of people in your seat didn't vote Labour and didn't vote for you. Why was it so tight?
It's not entirely surprising in an election that was about a big change from one party that's been governing for a long time. You often get quite tight margins then. And you're right, it is one of the tightest in the country. And I don't forget that at any point. You know, contrary to how you open this, now I'm very, very focused on the next election and winning that, which is why I've got stuck into, right, what will really make a difference here on the ground for people. But in terms of why it was so tight, it's very clear that this is a part of Kent that's been less behind in many ways. You know, we've got a lot of struggles in the area with Kent County Council not really fully understanding some of the needs in the constituency, particularly the most deprived parts like on Sheppey. And where you get areas with high levels of deprivation, you also get lots of people who frankly feel disenfranchised by the whole political system. So whether that's Labour, whether that's Conservatives, you know, people have been in power. I absolutely get that people have lost faith that you'll get any real, not just change, which, you know, yes, we ran on a slogan of change, but the real thing I want to focus on is improvement. You know, we've got to make things better. And people have lost faith that anyone in politics will make things better. So, and of course that suppresses turnout, and it was a low turnout election. It also means people are looking for different options and different choices. And I think, and I do understand this because Labour hasn't been in power for a long time nationally. People were wary of, would we actually do what we said and what we promised, but also deliver, not just deliver what's in the manifesto, frankly, deliver what people really want. And what matters for that is what winds up in people's pockets at the end of the day. It's bread on the table issues. It's about the services and the public services. So I'm not surprised it was so tight. And as I say, if you want to come around to parts of, you know, particularly the north of Sittingbourne, particularly Sheppey with me, you will see areas with very high levels of deprivation comparable to anywhere else in the country. And at the same time, people have actually with a real strong sense of identity and pride in the area, but it's like that's been, the aspiration has been squashed out of people, unfortunately. So one of my jobs is to really see, can take that pride in the area and actually match that with better outcomes for people's day-to-day lives. I mean, that's a politician's answer. I've obviously been doing this for 6 months now. That actually did almost sound like a politician's answer. So I think I apologise for that.
Reform did very well in your seat and elsewhere in Kenya. I'm from Dover and they came second in Dover. Do you think the Reform Party is a major threat to Labour if the government doesn't perform well, particularly on migration over the course of the coming Parliament?
So I've never counted the Conservative Party out ever, anyway. So I know some people are very keen to write the Conservative Party off. It's one of the most resilient political parties in the world ever. So I'm not writing those off. And I still think they are the biggest players. But Reform are clearly arguing to be a replacement for the Conservative Party with a slightly different edge. So now I'm very focused on Reform, but also then why people would vote Reform in the first place. It's not focusing on Reform to me first. It's focusing on the voters and the electorate, on what really matters to them. But yeah, they're clearly angling to be on the up. I see that they're after a big injection of cash from overseas. I find that unnerving. I don't think this is something we've tried to knock out of our politics in this country. And it worries me that seems to be what Reform are after, especially off the back of saying, you know, they want British sovereignty and they want Britain to stand on its own two feet again. That's a worry. And I also worry, what I worry about with Reform most of all is it's a very powerful, simplistic message. A sort of, with one simple action, you will fix social care and transport and housing and everything else in the country. And it's a very strong message of, you know, about migrants and people that are settled here as well. To be honest, it comes across to me like those adverts online with this one simple life hack, you could be slim, or this one simple life hack, you know, you can be beautiful or more productive. It's that level of politics. And I think it's very hard to deal with when the truth is that actually getting real change on the ground that is sustainable and lasts takes a lot of effort on a lot of different fronts.
You mentioned earlier that the election in July was a very low turnout election. It was low in your seat, but it was low nationally. If you look at the vote for Labour nationally, plus the turnout population and the actual population of the country, it only works out to about 20% of people in the country who would be eligible to vote actually vote for the government. And does it concern you that this, you know, I think it's a strong case that this government has the largest majority and the weakest popular mandate of any government since universal suffrage?
Yeah, no, I've seen that. And I've certainly had plenty of people writing to me with those stats. And it's not surprising. And the whole thing in my, you know, I'm very aware that when people are communicating with me, most people in the seat either voted for someone else or have a different opinion. And also, I'm also very well, one of the things I hate in politics is where we talk about voter apathy. I don't actually believe people are apathetic about politics. I genuinely believe that it's often it's an active choice not to vote. It's an active choice of nothing's really right. And that people are turned off, not in the sense of it turns people off and puts people to sleep. Turned off in the sense they just don't see anything for them. So very much don't see it as vote and apathy. At the same time, the way that the Constitution in the United Kingdom is set up at the moment is one that promotes the formation of a government that can actually get stuff done. That's why we've got first past the post system. It's why we have a parliament that's set up so that if people do vote in a government, it can actually do things. And part of the problem over the last few years is we've either had governments with very slim majorities that haven't been able to get anything done, or a government like the last one, because when Boris Johnson won in 2019, he had a huge majority. Everyone was saying Labour would be out of power for 10 or 20 years, but still didn't actually get enough done because it spent so much time fighting amongst itself. So the way that the British Constitution is supposed to work is get a government in that can do stuff. For me, going forwards, what matters to make all those people who may be uncertain about various political parties or who have actively decided not to vote actually feel reconnected to politics again. That's why we're pushing for a new settlement in English devolution so that we move a lot of those Westminster powers much closer to where people live. That in and of itself, I think, will make quite a difference to people's, not just to people's lives, because we'll actually have, you know, strategic local authorities that will actually be able to get the stuff done that matters, like fix the mess of our transport system or, you know, integrate health and social care locally or, you know, get policing fixed. Not just because it will do the practical stuff, but because it will be bringing a lot of the powers that are currently in Whitehall or currently in Westminster and bring them much, much closer to the ground, much, you know, where people are, you know, directly electing mayors or, and that I think will make a huge change because I think suddenly people will feel, if we get that right, people will feel more connected to the political process and be able to see the link between who you vote for and the change that happens in your daily life.
Well, I guess we'll have to see, especially with all of us covering and being involved in local politics. Kevin McKenna MP, thank you very much for joining us.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
This week, the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, published her white paper detailing how Labour wants local government to look in the future. Kent will almost certainly have a mayor in the style of Andy Burnham in Manchester, but it will probably lose every council in the county, bar the parishes, and be replaced by a smaller number of unitary authorities. That much we know, but not a lot else. Kent County Council and Medway Council are leading the county's authorities in telling the government which type of setup it prefers, such as the Accelerated Devolution Priority Programme, which would mean rapid reform. They need to have those ideas into Angela Rayner by January the 10th, and judging by a letter seen to council leaders by the devolution minister Jim McMahon, there'll be no hanging about. It seems that the quicker a region gets on board, the bigger the dividend will be. But at the heart of it is the mayoral system, and we could have one of those in Kent as early as 2026. Rob, you spoke with Medway council leader Vince Maple this week. What was his take on the white paper and his general reaction to it?
Well, it's it's quite interesting. Vince has always been quite sceptical of a mayor. He's always said that he wants the powers that come with a mayor but doesn't need the extra level of bureaucracy. I think his view has certainly changed more recently. And
is that because there's not a Labour government?
I couldn't possibly say, but I think he's taking a more pragmatic view in terms of saying, I think the government's argument is you've got to get in to get on. And if you delay and stand around and say, oh, we'll wait a bit longer and stuff like that, you'll lose out. And I think that's kind of the argument that he's following.
There was no sense of that in Jim McMahon's letter this week. I've read it. Mm. Basically, it will happen. And depending on how you react, will depend on the kind of deal you get out of it. So I suppose in that way his hand's been forced a little bit, hasn't it?
A little bit, yeah. I think he also is quite conscious. I mean, the thing he kept sort of saying to me was, we're happy with the new powers, we welcome that sort of investment into the area and that sort of element to it, but we want to make sure we're doing it properly and getting it right. Mm. So it's not kind of a mess, and he wants everyone to be aware of what this will actually mean in terms of the council changes. One thing which he said was, no council within the county will look the same after this process is done. And for Medway specifically, although it's already a unitary authority, it is likely, if it's to reach that sort of 500,000 person sort of population size that the government has sort of laid out, it will probably grow by a double in size, basically. Exactly where that will come, even Vince couldn't tell me. He's not sure. There's lots of different options and that sort of thing. But I think he said, you know, as the only unitary authority, he's willing to sort of work with other ones and guide them through what a unitary authority looks like and how it operates and all that sort of thing. But he says he's looking to collaborate with all 14 council leaders in the county to sort of find the best possible solution.
Yeah. Medway, it's often been said that really is just not big enough to stand on its own, is it?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of some of the services, it already shares services with, say, Gravesham Council. It does licensing and things like that. Yeah. Swale, there's overlap with some of the health provisions and that sort of thing. So there's already cross-border collaboration in some senses. Mm. This would just be an extension of that and formalising it.
We have 13 geographical areas covered locally in Kent and KCC, which takes in all of the county bar Medway. Dan, can you give us an indication of how you think the county might end up sort of split into unit authorities, how many there will be, what sort of population sizes they'll carry, and which geographical areas they might take in?
Like Rob said, there's ambiguity about what will happen to Medway because it's already a unitary authority of, like, what, 250,000, 300,000 people. Across the rest of Kent, what I would imagine is that it will split along what many already perceive to be a long-standing cultural fault line between east and west. So places that are now, you know, Thanet, Canterbury, Dover, Folkestone, all of those areas would probably be part of one East Kent unitary authority. And areas, you know, Tunbridgewell, Sevenoaks, Dartford, all of that would probably end up being a separate West Kent unitary authority. Kent's population is almost 2 million and growing, so assuming very little change in population, I reckon it's most likely Medway will grow a little bit and then we split into east and west and we end up with three unitary authorities of sort of 500,000, 600,000, something like that. But once again, you know, who knows what they may come up with.
So you're looking at sort of like north Medway, the west and the south and the east type thing?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I don't see what other way they could do it unless they intend to split it up further and unify parts of it with Sussex or something like that. But that would surprise me if they gave that a go.
What about the political balance?
I don't know if it will make any difference, the overall political balance of councils. The defining feature of local government isn't that the geography of councils really changes things that much. People like to believe there's gerrymandering in this country, but I really don't think there is. It's not like the USA. What changes the political balance of councils is the fact that almost nobody votes for them. So I would imagine that, you know, an East and West Kent unitary councils will end up broadly like they are now. The more urban deprived areas on the coast of East Kent will have a slight Labour bias, and West Kent will be, you know, sort of permanent Tory hegemony with Lib Dems and Greens snapping at their heels. I don't think it'll make any particular difference on them.
What about the North and Medway? Labourish?
I would imagine so, but maybe, you know, if they need to absorb another 200,000-300,000 people to hit the numbers for unitaries, maybe they'll soak up every village between Medway and Maidstone, and those areas aren't exactly red-blooded as far as I understand it.
And of course, Reform is the great elephant in the room, isn't it? In terms of, you know, if it's a first-past-the-post system, who knows how these places might end up, if they've got maybe in East Kent, for example, and parts of the West. Reforms rise and rise.
seems to be ever present.
Yeah, I mean, I think if reform sort of galvanised feeling around immigration and general failure in public services and discontent with the government, especially in East Kent, in the coastal areas, in a future East Kent Unitary Authority, I don't think it's entirely out of the question that they could one day run it. You know, Thanet District Council was famously run by UKIP for a little while during the 2010s.
Brilliantly.
Yes, it didn't get very good reviews when they did it, but they got the votes for it just about. So I don't think that kind of thing's off the cards.
Nikki, you know, I'm not sure this change has really landed with the public, as far as I can see. What's your sense? When do you think that they will know?
Unfortunately for some of them, it probably won't be until the last minute. I think unless you're actually working for a local authority, and we know that there are thousands of people in this county that do, you probably haven't really caught up with what's going on. If you're talking about the ordinary man in the street, most of them, we keep coming back to it, they just want to know when the bins are going to be collected, when the potholes are going to be filled, all the things that affect their day-to-day life. And they won't worry about all the different things that are going on until something really impacts them. But it's important that they do take an interest, and how that message is put across, it needs to be done sooner rather than later.
Before with this big regional mayors that we've got already, like Andy Burnham, I mean, Andy's quite a big name. He was a bit of a name before he went into the job as mayor in Greater Manchester, but he certainly gives the air of being a man who commands a bit of respect and seems to take pretty sensible decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you are looking at it from down here in the south, you will see that big character, and you will see him doing perhaps what are the headline things and making things happen for his area, whether you agree with it or not. So that persona will be there, but whether you feel that that's the right thing for down here, I don't know. So, you know, I think what will happen is that people will start to realise, they will start to hear the headlines about the amount of money that's being spent on this happening, and they'll wonder why it's being spent on what they see as administration and not on the day-to-day stuff.
And there will be, I mean, we were talking about this in the office earlier on, that if you look at Medway and KCC, they employ between them about 10,000 people. If you take in the other authorities, probably another 6,000 or 7,000, plus all the contractors and the ancillary workers, all the companies that depend on these authorities. Okay, I mean, not all these jobs are going to go, but a lot of them probably will, because you won't need 14 chief executives, you won't need 14 heads of legal.
Yeah.
You would have to you'd have to shed some people or absorb them in slightly different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be big changes for an awful lot of people and the services that feed into it. So yeah, it's important to get that message out, but you know, we've spoken, a colleague mentioned not long ago when it was the general election, she went to pick up her kids at the school gates the next day, and one of the mums didn't even know there'd been a general election the day before. So unfortunately, this is sometimes the people that you are dealing with.
Yeah.
People are either politically engaged or they're not. Everything that happens is going to affect all of us, and it's better to get that message out sooner rather than later.
Rob, I just wanted to ask you, you've had a chance to read the white paper thoroughly. You've seen the letter to the council leaders from Jim McMahon. I mean, this is not a discussion document. This is a document telling these councils exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. You don't get the sense that this is going to be a long-term proposition for any council in the country?
No, I think this is definitely, the government has set out, this is the direction they want to go in. I mean, even among the options that are sort of outlined, the strategic layer, which is the layer with the mayors in it, one of the options which councils can go for is to have basically the structure of a mayor without a mayor in place.
Sounds good.
It sounds good, but from my conversation sort of with Vince Maple, the leader of Medway Council, it was kind of suggested that councils that pick that option will still end up with a mayor, because they'll set up these new structures where the mayor, just without the mayor at the top, and as soon as that's done, the government will say, right, it's time to have a mayor now. You know, you've got everything in place to get it done, so you're having one. I think this is kind of, it's concluded already.
Given the size of Kent, given the complexity of Kent, one would assume, and this is what I hear, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that the general feeling between those at the top of KCC is that possibly the accelerated form of the travel will be the one that that they'll be pressing for. If the government allows them to take it, they may see that it's not suitable.
Yeah.
But it's certainly on that, it seems to be on that programme. Do you think these changes in time will be good for Kent.
I can certainly see the argument from the government. I mean, the classic argument about unitary authorities specifically is less waste. They've sort of consolidated all of the responsibilities of councils in one place, and theoretically that means they're more efficient and all that sort of thing. In terms of the mayor, I think it definitely could be positive for Kent. An overarching, wider view of organisation, particularly around planning, around police, around health, could make things a lot more smoother and offer better services. But only time will tell, really.
Yeah. I suppose it brings us to the point where we've got to start speculating about who might actually go for a mayor. I mean, I think I mentioned on the podcast a couple of weeks ago that Craig McKinley said that he wouldn't rule himself out of running for it, the Conservative MP, who came to national attention in the last few months by losing basically his arms and legs and to sepsis, and suddenly comes off as a huge public figure as the bionic lord he's now. And his name was certainly mentioned in pretty glowing terms as a possibility. Any ideas yourself?
Well, I think one suggestion which I've come up with, who I think absolutely wouldn't do it, but if they did, I think would be a strong contender, would be the former MP for Chatham and Aylesford, Tracy Crouch. She's got very, very, very popular within the county, and I think if she stood, she would definitely win, though I don't think she'd be interested in any shape or
form. She has got that sort of no-nonsense sense about her that she would take a role on. What about you, Nikki? Any names to throw on her?
Well, without just copying Rob, I think he's got it spot on there. I mean, Tracy, whether you agreed with her politics or not, you have to say that she stood up for what she believed in, and she took action over things that she believed in, quitting roles, really making a public stand. And I think you need that kind of character to do that.
You need a name.
You do need a name. You want to be popular, but sometimes you've got to make a really difficult choice. And I think it's got to be somebody who's going to be strong enough to make that tough decision and say, OK, this is what I think is best for the county, and stand up to government as well when they think that this is the right thing for Kent, but not necessarily what they want from Westminster. But we'll see.
It depends whether really it's Westminster, it starts to try and drive these appointments internally, certainly from the party politics side of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what one would expect, because generally speaking, Kent has traditionally been conservative, that you would think that it's more likely to return a conservative mayor than a non-conservative mayor.
Yeah, probably. And you've got the likes of Kelly Tolhurst as well, who, again, was another person who wasn't frightened to throw a hat into the ring and make her views known. So.
Yeah. Not prepared to toe the line.
Yeah.
Dan, any thoughts? Who's your tip for the top?
Matthew's got the PCC. I reckon he would give it a crack, not least because if I understand the reports rightly, areas where the police authorities line up geographically with the strategic authorities across multiple unitaries, the PCCs will be abolished, which means he'll be out of a job. So I reckon he'll probably go for a promotion. And if not him, then Nigel Farage, long-standing man of Kent, known to have an address or two this side of the Thames. And while he's the MP for Clacton, unless they set some legal restriction on MPs also being mayors, I don't see why he wouldn't give it a go, and I reckon he'd probably stand a very good chance of winning if he put his mind to it for long enough.
Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Nikki, and our special guest, Kevin McKenna, MP. As I mentioned, it's the last podcast of the year and we'll be back in January. In the meantime, don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up for our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. Finally, Merry Christmas from us all here at Kent Politics Podcast, and we'll see you again in 2025 for what is sure to be another bumper year of politics and political news. See you later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.